Hi there, this is Michael Helbling for the Digital Analytics Power Hour. I'm excited because we are coming up on our 100th episode as a podcast. Mo, Tim, and I have been brainstorming like mad, trying to figure out how to make this episode special. And we've come up with, I think, a great plan. We want to make it special by including what's most special about the podcast, and that's you, our listeners. So we want you to submit your questions we can answer on the podcast. And here's the great thing. If your question gets selected, you win a great prize that's unique to the podcast, 100th episode. So submit your questions. Here's how you do it. You send a 30-second audio clip introducing yourself and then your question in 30 seconds or less to contact@analyticshour.io. Again, that's contact@analyticshour.io, and your sound bite or question clip, just include it in your email, introducing yourself and asking your question, and then you'll be in the running. Any question goes. If you get selected, you win a great prize. We're going to take submissions from the time you hear this up until September 15th. So from now until September 15th is when the submission deadline is. So submit your questions. We're excited to hear from you, our audience. Make you guys part of our special 100th episode. All right, let's get it going. Oh, bonus points for anyone who includes the words quintessential analyst when speaking about Tim Wilson.
Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Tim, Michael, Mo, and the occasional guest discussing digital analytics issues of the day. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/analyticshour and their website analyticshour.io. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 97. Have you ever thought to yourself, hey, I need to hire an analyst, and not just any old person, but someone who really fits the bill? Or have you ever thought to yourself, hey, I need to get hired as an analyst, and not just for any job, but one that really fits the bill? Well, not to oversell it, but the next hour will potentially change your life, provided you listen to this podcast and then immediately win the lottery. Now, let's introduce our hosts.
Hi, I'm Mo Kiss from The Iconic.
And I'm Michael Helbling.
And I'm Tim Wilson from Search Discovery.
All right. And now we need somebody who can help discuss this topic. And probably a lot of people could, but we were keen to chat again with a former guest and a friend of ours, Simon Rumble. You will recall that he is the co-founder of Snowflake Analytics. It's a specialized consultancy around snowplow analytics. And prior to that, he led data analytics and CRM at Bauer Media. Welcome back to the show, Simon.
Thank you. Mo tells me I'm one of a very elite group of people who've been invited back, or you've run out of useful idiots or something.
Well, actually, we've invited most people back. You're just one of the very few who's accepted. Yeah. this is rarefied air. I mean, I've been on the show many times, but you're one of the few who's come back as a double guest. So welcome.
Yeah. Nice to be here.
Well, all right. Let's get this topic started. We're talking about trying to identify, assess analytics talent across the board. So let's dive in.
So a few weeks ago, Simon and I were wandering down Pitt Street and I started to hit him up about finding good talent because he seems to have this weird knack for spotting the gems in the myriad of applications. And I kind of started asking him, like, what actually helps you inform your decision? So Simon, there's a few people in your team who have all gone on to have pretty incredible careers who I have a lot of respect for. What helped you identify those people in the first place? Like, what do you think made them stand out?
Yeah, I've had a bit of a kind of pattern I've used for a while hiring people. So I start with hiring mostly juniors. So that's people who don't really have the skills I need. Mainly that's through necessity, because the people I need don't really exist or are too expensive or already taken. So you have to kind of create them. So the kind of approach I've often taken in the past, although that's changing a little bit as the kind of talent has changed, is to hire junior web devs. So that's the ad looks for junior web dev skills, but tells them that it's actually an analytics role. Most of my work tends to be fairly technical focused anyway, so it's less the analyst side of things, a lot more on the implementation side. So web devs are what you're after. And then you've got to meet a lot of people, and you read a hell of a lot of terrible CVs. And one thing that I can say that's universal about juniors is they write terrible CVs. You'll sit there for an hour talking to them, and you'll learn all this amazing stuff about the person. And then you say, so just a little bit of advice, all this stuff we've talked about, put it in the CV. Because they don't tell you what they've done. They tell you that they stacked shelves at Kmart and which subjects they studied in, you know, in primary school and stuff like that. Nothing useful. So meeting lots and lots of people and having them wash out, reading lots and lots of CVs, and then finally, I always do a technical written test. So, the written test is a great way to kind of confirm or not the things that you've decided in the interview.
And are those, but you said you're hiring people with web dev, but telling them it's analytics. Is the written test around the dev, like JavaScript type stuff? Or are you actually giving them a written test? I guess one, is the written test administered on site, or is it one that they can take with them? And then the second question is, what's the nature of those questions?
So I started using a test. I actually inherited it from my predecessor at an agency called Datalicious, but Mo has also been through that particular mill and gone through it. Look, we had a good time and we learned a lot. I won't say it was all fun and games, but we did learn a lot. But at that, I inherited a technical test for hiring juniors from there, and it covered, so this is going back some years, so it covered PHP, JavaScript, SQL, some general analytics questions, and that's kind of it. But the idea of the technical test was that you would say to the person being interviewed, if you don't know this stuff, it's fine to skip it and just tell us that you don't know it. If you feel like taking a crack at it, have a crack at it. If you've told us that you know something, either on your CV or in the interview, we kind of expect you to do that bit. But if you haven't, you know, that's okay. And if you've never seen PHP before, but you kind of get the syntax because it's similar to most C-derived languages, you know, have a crack at it. That's fine. And so that written test, it generally takes about 45 minutes to an hour. We tend to do it on site, although we've done it remotely for people who've interviewed remotely as well. And I've kind of evolved it and changed it fairly dramatically subsequently, but it's probably got the same kind of structure still, just because it kind of works. And, you know, I've used it for junior hires and senior hires, and it really does, it kind of points out the bullshitters, but also points out the amazing talent that you might not have realized was amazing. So I have an anecdote about that. So I've just hired Jethro, or actually a year ago hired Jethro for the third time.
For those who don't know him, he is an absolute super genius. I would be super lucky to work with him one day and my career.
Well, we're having him on the next episode to talk about what makes you leave a manager and yet come back again and again and again.
So when I first hired him, his CV, he hadn't finished high school. He did a tech college course in web development where he did VB and, you know, really unpromising CV. I brought him in anyway because he showed the right kind of interest. We had an amazing conversation. He said he had that spark of creativity and curiosity and wanting to know how stuff works. Then we set him loose on the test. He nailed absolutely every question, and he found an error in the test itself. We hired him, and it turned out, sure enough, like I've hired him three times. I think I've finally convinced him the third time round that it's not just me who thinks he's awesome. So that's good.
So has his performance on the test improved each time?
Yeah, I think the test is probably 70 or 80% written by him by now. So retesting him probably wouldn't be great.
So hiring juniors is a somewhat risky proposition, though. I mean, there's a lot more coaching that needs to go on. There's a lot more impact on the business in terms of they kind of can't hit the ground running. Is it, I mean, have you had any horror stories or like any times it's gone completely wrong that you could kind of share with the listeners that what you've learned?
Sure. Look, you've got to be willing to cut your losses really quickly with the juniors that you hire. So they've got to be, you've just got to be like within, in some cases, a week, you know that they're not going to work out, and you just have to cut them loose and go, look, this isn't going to work. Give them some advice and send them on their way. I try to be very generous with severance in those circumstances. You know, when they're on a probationary period under Australian employment law, we really don't have to give them much notice, but I think that's a bit of a dick thing to do. So we tend to give them some runway, but you've just got to be willing to cut really quickly. I haven't had any horror stories, that I'd say, because I think the written test really shows up what you've got. Probably the main one, I have hired people who've not had the right attitude. So they've had the right technical aptitude, but not the right attitude. And I think that's my radar for that has got better. I really do want voracious curiosity and interest and passion out of anyone. Because especially, you know, we're a consultancy. If you work for a consultancy, you're going to work really hard. You're going to be struggling a whole chunk of the time because you're not going to know what you're doing, and you're going to need to learn a huge amount of stuff. The upside of that is you're going to get exposed to a whole range of different problems, a whole range of different approaches, a whole range of different technologies. And, you know, within a year or 2 years of working, you're going to be an expert. You'll really be ahead of the game. So, you know, we need to find the people who want to get to that point.
Michael, you're kind of a hirer of juniors. I mean, you're kind of building both on the, I feel like we should make sure we get to the non-technical analyst as well as the technical analyst. But I know we've had that discussion in the past, but that's kind of your bread and butter as well, right?
Yeah, we definitely, you know, had to develop kind of a rationale ourselves. And so I think what's interesting is we also came down on this sort of intellectual curiosity being a core component. And like trying to identify that amongst all the things, to your point, you don't get much in a resume that tells you this person is like, likes to figure out why things tick, but you can figure it out in talking to someone.
How?
Well, one of my strategies is start a podcast with them so that you get a chance to interact over a number of years and you can really determine what kind of analyst are they really? And then, that's right, Mo, coming for you. Sorry.
We're not good enough friends yet, Helms.
I mean, I feel like I say that I avoid, I feel like I'm always bumbling, but sometimes I walk out of an interview and I'm super excited or I'm not. I don't really trust my intuition. And it's like, I really want that intellectual curiosity, but I don't know how to actually find it.
No, it's in there.
I often spend some time talking to them about the team and the project and what we do and how we work. And so I've done this both client side and you know, agency or consultancy side. You talk about what you do, what your ambitions are, and you can tell if they get excited about that. You know, they'll ask interesting questions. They'll follow up. They'll get involved in the conversation. That's the kind of person I want, is someone who gets enthusiastic about the project, you know, what we're working on.
Okay. So
yeah. And it's also just applying kind of to a question like, well, let me think about that. And then you can kind of see them kind of working on it. So we interview for kind of three main categories for people we recruit directly, say out of university. Which, you know, if we go down the person with experience, we do a kind of different recruiting process or interview process. So, but if we're recruiting out of university, that person's not going to have necessarily a deep background in analytics or those kinds of things. So we're looking for the precursors. And so that intellectual curiosity, problem solving, and sort of an estimating or thinking through the problem kind of capability. And so those are kind of the three main components that I think make up a really good person who can do analysis. On the technical side, I think there's just, you have to do a technical test. You just have to see where somebody's at. You can train people, but you got to see. And I think it's actually interesting sometimes people who don't do particularly well on a technical test are actually the people that you're more interested in because of how they went after it. You know, and I've been in the opposite situation where someone comes in and their, and you know, resume or CV says, oh, I'm, a, you know, got JavaScript or jQuery or whatever. And so I was like, well, how would you rate yourself? Like from 1 to 10? And they'd be like, oh, I'm like an 8. And so I'll be like, well, write, you know, could you write this down or, you know, this? And they're like, oh, and I'm like, yeah, see, I'm like a 1 or a 2 and I can do that. It's like, then the conversation gets really awkward. But it's important because you got to figure out like, well, how do people evaluate? And sometimes people are really down on their skills and you got to learn how to help them elevate them. And then some people overthink their skill set and you got to bring them kind of back down to, and it's a moving target and it's difficult for everybody. I remember a friend of mine, Akil here in Atlanta is trying to hire a developer for his team, an analytics team, and is really trying to help not only find the right talent, but kind of educate the market a little bit too for what they're looking for. And I thought that was really helpful. It's like, there's a difference between a developer and a programmer. And I don't remember which one was the one he thought you should be, but you know, be the good one.
Michael, I both want to call you on something and I'm going to make a point in the process. So,
oh boy,
I avoid interviewing because I hate it. I dread it. I don't feel like I'm that good at it, but my go-to method, and I will prep for them, is to use behavioral interviewing. And I was taught that is ask a question. Have you ever had a time of X? Cause I feel like people say behavioral interviewing, they don't really understand what it is. I was taught a very formal method of, tell me about a time when you did X, and then they say, and then you're listening for them to tell you the situation, tell you their behavior, and then tell you the outcome. And they will struggle. They will talk around that. Some will talk around the situation, and that gives me a very clear focus to say, okay, but what did you do? Yeah. And then even if the outcome was unsuccessful, that's okay. That's not a knock. It just, you walk through that. And to me, that is the one thing that I kind of hang my hat on. So therefore, given that you're looking for problem solving, what the fuck do you do to find problem solving? What is the question you ask, or do you go off of their resume and key off of that? So I'm going to ask you a behavioral question of how do you actually look for problem solving?
So I just ask a random question.
Or no. I want you to tell me about a time where you needed to find, that was my bad. My bad of asking the question.
But
tell
me about a time.
Tell me about a time when you actually needed to assess somebody's problem solving capability. And sure. How you went about that. And I'd like you to explain the situation, what you actually did or said, and then what they responded and what that told you.
Hey. Tim, that's called the STAR method. Situation, task, action, response. And it's actually, government might be old and bad in lots of ways, but government have been interviewing in this way for like at least 15 years.
It's called the STAR method, Tim.
STAR method.
Okay. That but could be.
Back to Holmes.
I'm trying to think. You were, Mo. You were in
grade school when I learned this method, and I haven't stayed up on the. So yes, okay.
Our method's so, awesome too.
Let me tell you about a time, Tim, when I was interviewing a candidate who is also now your coworker. And I needed to assess their problem solving capabilities. So in the course of our conversation, I simply pulled from current events to ask them a question of estimating how to solve a particular challenge, one that did not have an easy to resolve answer. And I'm looking in that conversation for them to apply assumptions, ask questions, build out a scenario, and basically walk around the problem and try to look at it from many different angles. And as they do that, their ability to do that and engage in that way is indicative to me of some of their problem solving capability.
But I mean, you literally said, so, you know, climate change, or, I mean, when you say current events,
it was the current event at that time happened to be a musical festival that was put on or attempted to be put on in the Bahamas called the Fire Festival. It was a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And all these people came to this lonely beach in the Bahamas, and there happened to be nothing there except some outhouses and maybe some bologna sandwiches.
Yep.
And so there were thousands of people stranded, and they're not the kind of people who appreciate being stranded. I believe the guy who did that actually is doing some jail time right now. Anyway, back then it was just a funny news story. But what we worked through was how many people are stranded and how quickly can we get them back to the mainland? And that was the problem.
Okay.
And now,
so, I mean, literally it wasn't a digital marketing challenge. It wasn't a digital analytics. It was literally,
because I don't think that's necessarily how you have to. I mean, if it was someone with experience, then I might come at them with a more specific digital analytics challenge with context around it and those kinds of things. But I just want to see them think about and have fun with solving kind of a hard to know problem. So where the Bahamas? Okay. How many people? How many people fit on a boat? How many people fit on a plane? How many pilots do we have? Is there a runway? How do we, like all these different things. And it's the creativity of assessing the problem and then determining the result. That's what's going to tell me the answer to the problem.
Like the classic, like how many pennies would fit in this room? I don't really care if you're right or wrong. I just want to hear you work.
Exactly. It's all about how you attack it.
So Simon or Mo, have you guys ever gone that route?
In my interview, I got asked whether or not the Iconic should open a warehouse in Melbourne. That was the question that was given to me. And
great question.
I actually walked out of the interview thinking I hadn't gotten the job. But the interview I thought was so much fun because it was me and one of the co-founders just like bouncing off each other, talking about the problem, like, okay, what assumptions should we make? How should we tackle this? And it was actually that talking through how we would tackle it that got me the job. But at the time I was like, oh shit, I didn't give him an answer. But the point is not the answer. The point is to talk through how would you actually go about tackling this if you went back to your desk and you had to figure it out.
But I mean, the $1 million question is, do they have a warehouse in Melbourne now?
We had one many years ago, many, many years ago, but we don't now.
I mean, so Simon, do you go that route? Do you do any of those types of questions, or is because you're mostly technical, you can stay Hugh closer to.
Yeah. I don't ask those kind of questions. I have a bit of an aversion to the, you know, how many M&Ms will fit in a, you know, 2 liter Coke bottle kind of questions. Cause I just think because they're so contrived, they're not necessarily that. I don't know. When people ask me those questions, they kind of piss me off. Because it's not like, you know, you ask me something real. I like your idea of, I like Mo's one of, you know, should this business open a warehouse in a new city? Because that would kind of do something. No, I don't.
But it serves that dual purpose, because if the interviewer was actually grappling with that, then he's getting to talk through it's kind of like Simon, where you started saying, I talk about what we're doing and the challenges we're facing. I mean, so it kind of combined both of those. And I'll say, I think Michael, like the fire festival example, that's got more tangible. It's like, this was a real problem that somebody faced, maybe not our business. Whereas I guess if you go one step farther to how many M&Ms fit in a 2 liter bottle or how many coins would fit in this room.
I like to build more story into it. And maybe, like, to your point, Simon, I think I would be annoyed by how many M&Ms, because it's so constrained.
Yeah.
Like, where's my freedom to be creative and really explore angles?
Although if they take off and start quoting James Surowiecki and Wisdom of the Crowds because of the anecdote that's early in that book, I'd probably just hire him on the spot. Right? Because they start with like counting. Well, sorry. That's a bit of a too obscure reference.
Yeah, don't worry. We'll put it in the notes.
But look, honestly, I think it's probably something I should do more of, because even when I'm hiring for a technical person, I still need analytical capability, because everything that we produce is going to go in the hands of an analyst at some point. So often I need instrumentation to service a query, you know, some question that the business has come up with. The tech person has to go and do that instrumentation. It's actually better for them to go and think about what questions might be asked or might be possibly asked and do the instrumentation, you know, up front anyway. So it is worth having that inquiring mind. I guess I kind of get around that by conversation, I suppose, is how I've done that. But I do like the slightly more formal way of doing it. So I think I'll try that out.
Yeah. Well, I am, if anything, I am informal. So I tend to ask very informal questions in the interviews and act informally, but I'm always judging.
These are people think, I thought I was just having, getting a cup of coffee in a Starbucks and chatting with this guy. It turned out I was interviewing.
Yeah. So I wanted to go back to something Michael said a little while ago about using a scale to get people to rate their skills, because it's something I've been giving so much thought to of late. And that's the issue that lots of women, when it comes especially to technical skills, and there is a 1 to 10 rank your SQL skills, a lot of women, and I include myself in that, like I would put myself very low on that scale, even though my skills might be higher. And I've been thinking about it in the context of like, okay, is a test always better then? Because then you're not asking people to self-assess. You actually are saying use your skills and then we're going to like figure out kind of where you sit on that spectrum. But I mean, is that the workaround?
It's also important probably to point out what the purpose of that question is. It's not actually to place someone on a scale. It's actually to figure out how far off the scale they actually are.
You mean how far? What do you mean by how far off the scale?
In other words, so all of us assess things in different ways. So how far apart are we in our own assessment of each? So actually, we even do this or done this in the past with our performance management, where the person and their manager will fill out separate sheets and they'll place a random dot on a chart that basically says, this is my level of performance in this category, and in this category, place a dot. And then basically, it's not important about where you place your dot. What's important is how far apart or close together you are when you combine them. And that's why you might ask that question. Certainly, because if I ask someone who then undervalues their skills, I'll know. Like, I got asked this question in an interview, like, how would you rate yourself in Excel? And I'm not as good as Tim, but I am pretty good at Excel.
On a scale of 1 to 10, I can rate myself about a 3. So,
yeah, exactly. And that's exactly how I responded. I was like, I'm probably in this range, but I'll tell you, I feel like the more you learn, there's more there is to learn. And that's what kind of excites me about Excel generally. So it's not a question where you're going to get someone to give you a number and then you stick them there because they said a wrong number.
Here's the next like thing that I've been struggling with, because as we all know, this show is my outlet for figuring out my future career and how I'm going to navigate it. So what happens with these tests? So Simon, when I applied for my job at Datalicious, I got given a test and they're like, oh, this should take you a couple of hours. I'm pretty sure I spent like 2 or 3 days on it and I didn't dare tell anyone. In fairness, I'd never worked in the industry. I didn't know any of the stuff. I'd never opened Tableau. I had to go do all this stuff. I actually think I even got Tableau somehow, like one of their sales rep to help me ingest the data because I'd never used it and I didn't know how. And anyway, it was this whole thing, but I spent like days on it. And ultimately, yes, I got the job. But is that something that as a candidate, I should just not tell anyone ever about if it takes you much longer than it should? Or is the fact that it takes you longer a sign that maybe you're not the right person for that job?
So just in defense of that test, that wasn't my test. So Datalicious has a tech side and an analyst side, and the analyst test was different. If it's the test that I did when I got the job out, because I had to do the analyst test as well as the tech test, it was a crap test. It really wasn't very good. I think they had a habit of just throwing whatever client problem they had that week at candidates and saying, here, have a go at this, without really framing them very well. So that's the thing. I think you need a test. It's got to be well crafted. So what you got may well have been 2 days worth of work for someone with no domain knowledge or knowledge of the tool or anything like that. So it's because I do a written test rather than a take-home test, and I actually want to talk about that, is you can actually gauge how long someone takes. And so one of the worst hires that I ever made took 2.5 hours on what should have been a 1 hour test. And from his performance after the fact, what we worked out is that he he must have cheated. He either phoned someone or was looking up all the answers on Stack Overflow or something like that, because he passed the test. He really shouldn't have.
Yeah, but hang on a minute. I think that, and we've talked about this, one of the key qualities that you're looking for is curiosity and ability to kind of self-solve and dig and find a solution. So, like, often every time I've had to do a test, it's been go home, you've got a couple of days to do it, and you can use whatever you want resource-wise. Is that the worst? Like, as long as they get the answer, does it matter?
So, I mean, there's degrees of needing help. That's the thing. We do the tests I always do. They're open. You're welcome to look stuff up, because you're not expected to remember the syntax of, you know, obscure programming language A or B. But if the entire test that you do is looking stuff up and it takes you so long that it's obvious you had to look everything up, that's a sign. It's a, and maybe the way to approach that is to do some follow up with a person who takes a long time, because it might just be that they're really nervous and they're really thorough and they're really keen to get it right. It might just be, you know, massive over attention to detail. And that's probably a positive trait. So maybe it needs follow up rather than straight wash out. But take home tests, I'm not a fan of. I mean, there's the simple cheating aspect of it. You know, people could just get someone else to do it, which means it's not necessarily that predictive. And you might say that doesn't happen. I say it does happen. It happens a lot. And I think that has a tendency to take up way more time of the candidate's time than is fair. And candidates like Mo will go and spend 2 days on something when they've been told it should take 2 hours, and you've just wasted 2 days of Mo's time. And I don't think that's fair. She's not getting paid for that.
Yeah, but I don't know. I see both perspectives. There's a bit of, like, also how much, and in that case, you know, when you're changing industries, you don't have any context. You do have to look up every single thing. But I guess it comes down to the how much is what you're looking for, those qualities, and how much of it is it like technical domain knowledge, and can one ever outbalance a lack of the other in the hopes that you are a good enough learner, you can pick that stuff up down the track.
Yeah. So we always have a discussion with the candidate after the test to talk through how they approached it. And if there's things where they went, oh, look, I've never done whatever programming language it is, but I kind of had a crack at it, and that's, we encourage them to do that, then that kind of couches that discussion in, well, you know, they don't know PHP, but they've done other programming languages, and you know what, their approach was sound. The syntax was wrong. It's not going to compile, but, you know, that's fine.
It seems like, not to shift to the strategy of the candidate, and I'll say up front, I don't want to have two episodes in a row where I wind up being the clueless dude, because Mo, you did kind of slip in the, like, as a woman. So now partly, you know, maybe we're being tested. I mean, I sort of am a fan of, like, just brutal honesty as a candidate or as an interviewer. Now I know that at one point wasn't even interviewing, but I managed to run a very good candidate off because I met up with the people who'd been interviewing, chatted with the guy in a bar, and pretty much apparently convinced him that he should run like hell from the agency. Now, I think I might have done the right thing for him, but the person who was trying to hire him wasn't real happy with me. But it seems like if they said 2 hours, they may have been telling everybody 2 hours for 2 years, and everybody's scrambling like crazy. It's not taking anyone 2 hours, but nobody's calling them on it. And it's just, you know, somebody thinking that it's a 2 hour test. But, like, why not be completely honest and say, you said 2 hours, this took me way more than 2 hours. Maybe you round down a little bit. And if they say, oh, well, shit, it should have taken 45 minutes, we don't want you, great. Like, why not be incredibly honest? Because what you're trying to do on both fronts is find somebody who's going to be the right fit. And what I'm hearing from all of you guys is it's trying to get them talking or doing in a way that you can get a little bit, where you're kind of forcing them to remove the mask of whatever they're trying to present. And you're trying to get one level down to who they truly are and what they truly know. And unfortunately, it's just kind of challenging is to figure out what to ask or exactly what to ask them to do in order to get there. But nobody wins if somebody bluffs their way through, right?
Right.
But isn't that the whole process? I don't know. I understand from like an interviewer perspective, you don't want people to bluff, but you kind of have to sell yourself too. Like you can't be like, oh, hey, I'm really shit. I'm awful. Please don't hire me. This took me 2 days instead of 2 hours. Like,
well, if you're shit at that, right? No, like you're
part of the interview process is selling yourself.
If I went to get hired for a finance position, and if I managed to figure out how to get hired for a finance position, I'm going to be miserable inside of a month and they're not going to like my performance. So I would say, I mean, okay, if you're like, I'm one paycheck away from being homeless and I got to get any old job. Yes. But in general, if you say, yeah, this was really tough, I don't know.
I think that's a really good question, Mo, because there are tactics in the interview process, sort of forms that one follows, if you will.
I'm going to ask you to be more specific. If you could maybe use an example of a situation and a tactic.
Oh, like a start. Yeah. I'm so done. I'm not trying to prove myself.
I'm sorry.
No, but like I'm Tim and I lead the charge with imposter syndrome, right? And I've overcome it more than Tim has. And now I'm really proud of myself. But it's hard to stand in there and be like, oh yeah, I'm a huge big time deal. You should totally hire me because I'm a big deal in analytics. But when you walk in the room, you have to have a perspective and you want to bring your best forward. And so a lot of times what I do, and actually this goes to a point of like when interviewing someone who's an analyst, who's an experienced hire, one of the most important things for me to get from that person is their grasp on narrative. Can they give me a really clear picture of how they drove something from within their organization they worked with, whether big or small? How did a really compelling picture, rich with detail, with lots of, you know, follow through and a mastery of what was happening. So it's not like, oh yeah, I instructed my team to do this. No, you did this. Like you got in there and you analyze the data, you brought these things forward, those kinds of things. Sorry, move that aside, back to sort of following these forms. You have to present yourself a certain way. You have to represent yourself a certain bit, but you don't have to walk in and not be yourself.
I don't think I'm saying like, don't be yourself.
Okay.
I'm just saying that you do have to sell yourself. And you kind of can't downplay your skills, because if you don't even believe in your skills, how can you expect anyone else to? And even though you might not believe in your skills, part of imposter syndrome is being like, well, I'm just going to fake it a bit until I make it, which does kind of work a bit. I just think if you cop out and just be like, I'm going to be totally blunt and be like, I don't know all these things, I don't think you're going to get a job.
I disagree, because I've done that and gotten the job.
It's a seller's market. People are desperate. What?
Yeah. Pulse? Wait, analytics, you're hired.
Can you spell it?
This is a really important thing it's easy for those of us who've got, you know, a history and skills that are in demand and, you know, enough money in the bank to cover the mortgage for the next month or two to kind of pick and choose our jobs and be ourselves. But when you've got the pressure of, I need a job, I really need a job, it's a different situation. And what terrifies me about interviewing is missing someone because they don't have the personality, my personality type. You know, someone who's shy, not self-confident, and can't talk well about their own skills and their own what they do. Part of what I try to do in interviews is draw those people out. Cause I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, cause I'm hiring techie people, they are the classic, you know, introvert, not able to talk themselves up kind of types. And the best ones don't believe in themselves. You know, they really struggle to tell you why you should hire them, you know, from the CV all the way through. So it's about finding those people.
So I really like that. That's what we're going to is that we want to recognize those. But I'm also, as you're talking, like, I feel like with interviewing, there are times where we fall in this trap of we have to find the great candidates, and we better not misfire. But it is a type one, type two problem that is all of a sudden I have playing in my head all the stuff I've been getting thanks to Matt Gershoff and others, you know, better about that interviewing is inherently imperfect. And Simon, you said early, you're going to misfire and be prepared to say, we're not going to know that until 2 or 3 months in, and, you know, eject them like a virus would be the Thriving on Chaos. Is that the book? Built to Last. But that interviewing is inherently, it's not like you're trying to get to 100%. Like the best model would be everybody has to work for you for 3 months, and then you'll get to where maybe 80% of or 90% of your hires are good. And so that seems like that's this other piece of it, is actually being okay with, it's not going to be perfect. Interviewing is inherently flawed, but recognizing what are your shortcomings. I'm going to gravitate to people who are extroverted and informal. I better make sure that it doesn't let me undervalue, you know, people who are not.
Yeah. And I mean, there's two different approaches to hiring. There's like, I would characterize the Google approach to hiring is that they never want to make a bad hire, but that means that their process is ridiculously onerous. And I've hired plenty of people who washed out of Google's hiring process, and they've been awesome. So it's, you know, they have the never hire a bad egg approach. I'm happy with occasionally messing up, and like I said, yeah, get rid of them and do it quickly.
Yeah, I mean, my approach has been to mess up less and less over time. Ideally,
sure, of course,
yeah. But it's, to your point, you can't get it right all the time from an interviewer's perspective. I think from the interviewee's perspective, sometimes you don't get it right either, because you pick a job that actually you're not going to like. You don't assess the company or the role for yourself. And I think that's probably, like, we haven't really talked about it, but that's actually equally important. What kind of job are you going to love?
I was watching something the other day, which seems so relevant right now. One of our engineers shared it. Her name's Aubrey Blanche, and she's, I can't remember her exact title now, but she works at Atlassian in the people and culture team. And she talks a lot about the hiring process and how you make sure you have a really diverse team. And one of the points that she makes that I absolutely love is, we need to stop talking about cultural fit, because cultural fit means I'm going to hire someone like me. And that's not necessarily constructive. So what we need to talk about is, are they a good values fit? Like, here are our five company values. Does that person believe in those values? How are they going to demonstrate them in the workplace? Because as soon as you say cultural fit, you're hiring an extroverted, say, white dude that is interested in, like, taking out the cats next door with a water gun.
My understanding is that I thought cultural fit winds up, I thought, when I've seen companies that have had that as part of their process, is they look at the people who embody their values the most and then say, and that may be kind of flawed. I don't think I've ever been asked to give a cultural fit interview as one piece of
it.
I absolutely would expect that you would. I'm more judging how often I manage to embody the values of the organizations that I work for. Yeah. I haven't been tapped for that.
Well,
as a matter of fact, just this week, I'm asked to interview someone, and it is not for a cultural fit.
To your point, Mo, actually, in the very beginning of the book, The Undoing Project, which we've talked about on the show before.
Oh, what an asshole.
You were dead to me. Are you gonna do me?
Is that going to be your last call?
Oh, my God.
You're in so much trouble. Someone was not
paying attention.
Erase this. Just erase this. We'll erase it. I just loved how the general manager of the Houston Rockets wouldn't let anyone on his scouting team talk about this person as like this person when they're talking about basketball players, unless they could say it in the context of them being a different ethnicity. And I thought that was amazing, because it literally stopped that comparison in its tracks. And I was like, that's genius. And to your point,
that's in The Undoing Project?
Yeah, and like in the foreword.
But restate that again, so I haven't read it. So
basically, what was happening was scouters were making comparisons between players. And because they looked similar, they were equating their player skills as being the same, because they were 6 foot and they were both, Yeah.
Okay, that's like Moneyball with them saying that he has a baseball or he has a baseball body and okay. Mm-hmm. Got it.
And so, this is why so many teams missed on Jeremy Lin, who had, and they made this point in the book, had some of the quickness that he had was like unheard of. And as a player, it was like off the charts, and yet nobody was seeing it because their comparisons were off. And so the way that the general manager of the Houston Rockets tried to rectify this was by making it so that you were not allowed to make those comparisons unless you could, be like, this is an African-American player, but I'm going to compare him to Steve Nash or something like that. And then you could truly see it. Anyways, I know that's not a values fit, but I really love the way in that scenario, in that world, that he tackled that little problem.
But I think that's the same problem, right? Is like when you – what Audrey's point is that when you talk about cultural fits – you often are making that same mistake of like, that's this right. person is like that person like or me. Like me, and therefore they're going to suit our organization.
All right. This has been a great conversation, but we do have to wrap up. But before we do that, let's go around the horn, do a last call. It's the thing we do, something we've seen recently, we think might be of interest. Simon, you're our guest. What's your last call?
So this is kind of random, but it's something that Quartz sent out a few weeks ago, and it's a YouTube channel called Primitive Technology, and it's this guy with a science degree who runs a lawn mowing business in North Queensland. So this guy goes out into the bush, and he's got this property and tries to recreate technology from scratch. So he starts by, if he wants shelter, he starts by harvesting grasses, drying them and weaving them so that he can make himself a thatch hut. And then he decides he wants to make iron so that he can start making the next level of tools. So he has to build a smelter that smelts the iron molecules out of bacteria to then melt down so that he can then finally turn those into tools and stuff. And it is really incredible stuff. So there's two tips on this I'll give you. One is read his WordPress site as well and turn on closed captions in the YouTube channel so that you can see, because he actually writes in notes of what he's doing. But he never talks. It's just really strangely meditative watching, and the storytelling process is incredible. I'm a bit hooked.
All right, Tim, you want to go next?
Sure. So I have done posts from this site before as last calls, but it's the pudding is the site, pudding.cool. And the post that I'm going to use in my last call is Life After Death on Wiki, Life After Wiki Death, something like that. But what they've done, and I love the pudding just because they do such a phenomenal job of both going deep in data and laying out kind of a narrative online as you kind of scroll through it. But this is an analysis of the page view data available from Wikipedia, and they have gone through and looked at when celebrities die, there is a spike in traffic to that celebrity's page, and looking at kind of how big that spike is, what the fall off is, comparing various celebrities to each other. So it's just kind of fun. It's a little interesting diversion, and it's using page view data, which is data that we're all very, very familiar with. So it's kind of a fun little diversion.
All right, Mo, I'm going to let you go last. That way nobody will remember what we talked about before. So my last call is the Digital Analytics Hub, which is coming up in October, so about a little over a month from now. So it's a conference I've attended many times. I really, really like it. I want to tell you how much I like it. I like it so much, I'm giving up my spot to go to someone else on my team who I think will benefit from it, because I really think it's something else. So if you have the chance, go to the Digital Analytics Hub. Plus, it's in Austin, Texas this year. I believe it's mid-October, like the October 17th-ish timeframe. Some really great workshops before and great huddle-based conversations for 2 days in Austin, Texas. Worth your time. All right. Mo, what is your last call?
Well, my last call has already been ruined, but I just wanted to say a big thanks to Fred Pike, who recommended, I saw him at Super Week and then again at CXL, and he kept on my case about reading The Undoing Project, which I was so resistant to read because I don't know why. It's just sat on my bookcase for 6 months, and I'm now set, like, I'm getting everyone to read it because I'm absolutely loving it. Just hearing the story of Tversky and Kahneman has been amazing. I'm obsessed. I was like asking people on my holiday a month or so ago about all the tests that they run with their students. And I kept asking people on holidays to test it out and see if that's what people actually do. So if you haven't read The Undoing Project, I really, really recommend it.
You neglected to mention that you actually received an email from Daniel Kahneman.
No, but that was kind of exciting, although very, very short and sweet. But
all right. Well, this has been a really awesome conversation. I'm sure if you've been listening, you might have a couple points about how you interview or how you've gone through interviews that help refine the process of identifying the best talent. We'd love to hear from you. The best way to do that is through the Measure Slack. And actually, Simon's on there as well and is active under the name Shermozzle, which I think is your Twitter handle too. So reach out to him there. I'm sure he'd be happy to connect with you. We'd love to hear from you, Slack, Twitter, or on our Facebook page. We're happy to hear from you. Also remember, just a few more days, we're still accepting entries, questions for our 100th episode, extravaganza, spectacular, where Tim answers 100 questions from 100 listeners. No, I'm just kidding. That's not how many there are.
But really, we are excited about our 100th episode. So please send us your questions. We're really looking forward to that. The deadline is, again, September 15th, so just a few days from now. All right. Well, once again, Simon, it's been a pleasure speaking with you again. Thanks for coming again on the show. And obviously, for my two co-hosts, Mo and Tim, I want to say to all of you out there, no matter what your talent level, keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening, and don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Measure Slack group. We welcome your comments and questions. Visit us on the web at analyticshour.io, facebook.com/analyticshour, or at analyticshour on Twitter.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Tim's just going to have a heart attack over there.
Tim and I's work styles are very different.
Yes, they are. And we keep finding people who write us up as being like a top 5 or top 10. And one really had like a basically called us out as just being people who like each other and have a good time. Like...
We should send them a cease and desist letter. It says my VoIP connection to Mo has failed again, and Mo, you're not muted. Nothing bad is going to happen from here.
Well, it's light, witty, and deeply personal. So I feel like, I'm not sure we've gone deeply personal, which just adds to its charm.
Let's get real for a minute. I've been hooked on cocaine since 1992. Mo, how you do it in rehearsal is how you do it in performance.
Hey, Michael, what are you wearing?
Actually, you know what? I got a new pair of jeans, and they are really comfortable. I really like them.
Maybe you should call him, like, the Tim Wilson of Australia or something.
Ooh. Who is that more insulting to?
I don't know. That's why I like it. It's like...
Why don't you call him the Tim Wilson of Australia, Mo? Mo, this is where you just say, I'm Mo Kiss.
I didn't know we were doing that today.
That's why I put it in there that way.
Michael? Michael can't hear me. Yeah. Son of a bitch.
Now Mo can't hear you.
Okay, now you're back again. You went all gray.
But now I'm back.
No, Tim went gray.
Yeah, this is gonna suck.
Mo, Tim can't hear you.
Oh, man.
Okay, Michael, they can't hear you.
I can now. I'm back. Yeah. But now Simon can't. Simon's refreshed.
Simon. Okay. Sorry, yeah, I didn't hear anything you said, Michael.
No, that's okay. Just assume I gave an amazingly sensitive and gender-balanced answer, and then go from there.
Okay, you know, this is going great, but we have got to wrap up.
Tim is dead. I can hear you two guys, I can't hear help, so I have no idea what he just talked about.
Oh, bollocks.
Rock flag and tricky questions.